For his second term, the U.S. president-elect has assembled a team of loyalists comprising far-right Christian nationalists and neocon-style militarists, leading us to potential disaster. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, following Donald Trump's victory, the United States president-elect Donald Trump wasted no time in assembling his foreign policy team. It is not certain that all of his nominees will be confirmed, but the people he has put forth give us a good idea of what a Trump 2 foreign policy will look like, and it's every bit the nightmare we feared. A few of his picks have even surprised some Republicans. But if the first Trump term is any indication, even those who manage to overcome this confirmation process in Congress may not last very long in office. Still, the nominations themselves tell us a lot about what Trump's foreign policy approach will be this time around. They also tell us that Trump himself intends to be more central to the policy process, and that his cabinet will play less of a role in policy formation than it did in his first term. Trump's nominees reflect an extreme approach to foreign policy, especially in the West Asia region. For all of Trump's talk on the campaign trail about being the anti-war candidate, he wasted no time in shedding that illusion. His first move was to task Brian Hook with leading the State Department's transition team. Hook is a leading Iran hawk and was a strong voice in favor of the so-called maximum pressure strategy that Trump employed and which President Joe Biden largely maintained. The strategy led to Iran accelerating its nuclear program and heightened tensions in the region. Hook was also a key player in crafting the Abraham Accords, Trump's plan which brought about normalized relations between the Zionist regime and the United Arab Emirates as well as Bahrain, disregarding the concerns of the Palestinian people. Trump's subsequent picks raised many more eyebrows. Trump began by nominating former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee as the ambassador to Israel. He has no experience in foreign affairs and is a radical Christian Zionist who believes the entire Greater Israel is a divine gift to the Jewish people and explicitly denies the very existence of a Palestinian identity. House Representative Elise Stefanik, who has led the charge in Congress to demonize supporters of Palestinian rights with spurious charges of anti-Semitism, is Trump's pick for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Though it's hard to imagine anyone doing more to undermine international law and Palestinian rights than the current ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, Stefanik's success in melding the concepts of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism together is a dire warning. Trump's pick for National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is a man who believes in military force to achieve policy goals. He's an extreme Iran hawk and has a strongly implied support for the Zionist regime's ambitions to confront Iran. Marco Rubio is Trump's nominee for Secretary of State and has foreign policy views cut from similar cloth as Waltz. Rubio is a strong supporter of the U.S. military force and sanctions and is less enthusiastic about diplomacy. Some describe his approach as similar to the neoconservatives who got the U.S. into the disastrous war on Iraq. On the intelligence side, Trump's nominee for director of the CIA, John Ratcliffe, served in the first Trump administration. His approach to military force is similar to Rubio and Waltz. But the pick for Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, has been of two minds on the question of military intervention, although she is also seen as espousing Islamophobic views. She has long been among the most outspoken opponents of regime change interventions and using American military might for political ends. But she's a strong proponent of the so-called war on terror and believes in using military force aggressively in that front. Gabbard is a mix of views on other issues as well. She opposes Israeli settlement expansion, yet has called the BDS movement anti-Semitic, even while also voting against using the law to stifle boycotts. But perhaps the most frightening of Trump's nominees is former Fox News personality Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense. Hegseth has tattoos representing the most hardcore Christian nationalism, images that reflect not faith, but praise for the crusaders of the Middle Ages. Not only does he support using U.S. troops on American soil, which could put the lives of Palestine solidarity protesters at grave risk, but he has also supported building the third temple where the Al-Aqsa Mosque currently stands and called for a crusade against Muslims. Taken together, Trump has assembled a team that is mainly composed of far-right Christian nationalists and neocon-style militarists. True, Gabbard, who many deride as an asset, although there is no hard evidence to sustain this beyond her position to the war in Ukraine and indeed her alarming defense of other countries, does not fit neatly into either of those categories, but she is exceptional among Trump's early picks. Trump's interest in foreign policy has always waxed and waned, but this time around, he seems intent on exercising more complete control over policy. In his first term, Trump's top foreign policy staff included people who had some foreign policy experience and had a cache of respect and supporters in Washington, the military, and the global business world. They included people like former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, generals like Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster, neocon John Bolton, and longtime CIA officer Gina Haspel. By the time he had replaced all of these people with a crew less versed in foreign affairs and more loyal to Trump personally, the COVID-19 pandemic had taken Trump's attention away from foreign affairs. Many observers in Washington believed that Trump had brought in generals and executives with a great deal of global experience to dispel doubts about his own inexperience in foreign policy. This time, as he infamously said in an interview shortly before the election, he wants people who will support his decisions, not debate them or offer alternatives.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly programme that analyses markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So, let's check out the Tasty Grub. To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging. Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices. This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency. The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions, worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, that the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. So, but that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you. Especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
In the limelight.
A prominent Republican U.S. senator has pledged that Congress would not give blanket approval to Donald Trump's controversial cabinet picks ahead of the congressional confirmation process, as a leading Democrat challenged the qualifications of some of Trump's proposed nominees. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. Sources close to Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., are saying that he has emerged as the family's most influential advisor, as his father builds the most controversial cabinet in modern US history. Donald Trump Jr. has in some cases promoted inexperienced loyalists over more qualified candidates for top positions in President-elect Donald Trump's incoming administration. During Trump's first administration as the 45th president, his eldest daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner were top-level political advisors, while his sons Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump were assigned mainly to run the family business. Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner took a big step back from politics after Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election, and during Trump's subsequent descent into a tangle of civil and criminal cases, Ivanka and her husband withdrew from politics. Though more recently, since Trump's election victory on 5th of November, they have come back. Now, sources have told the Reuters news agency that Donald Trump Jr. is currently the leading offspring voice in his father's ear, and the president-elect has become particularly reliant on his son for advice on White House strategy. But at least two of the more controversial choices championed by Donald Trump Jr. face tough Senate confirmation hearings. Vaccine skeptic and conspiracy theorist Robert Kennedy Jr. for the post of Health Secretary, and former Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence. There are concerns, bipartisan concerns, over Tulsi Gabbard's Russian interests and lack of experience. The Washington Post reported appointments planning continued on Sunday, 24th of November, with the likely elevation of Jay Bhattacharya, a Stanford-trained physician and economist, as the next director of National Institute of Health. Reuters news agency spoke to half a dozen sources, including donors, political allies and friends, who confirmed Donald Trump Jr.'s influence in pitching names for appointments, including inexperienced loyalists. Donald Trump Jr. was credited with making J.D. Vance his father's vice presidential pick, helping cabinet contenders sink or rise to the fore and blocking former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo from joining the cabinet. Donald Trump Jr. told Fox News Channel, "The reality this time is we actually know what we're doing, and it's about surrounding my father with people who are both competent and loyal." Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and formerly Trump's senior advisor who focused on West Asia matters, told Reuters news agency that he's briefing real estate investor Steve Witkoff on his new job as special envoy to the region. Jared Kushner said, through a spokesperson, "I have been working with Witkoff to get him up to speed on Trump's past efforts." One source close to the transition said Trump does not appear to need his family for advice as much as in the past because of aides like Susie Wiles, who helped to run the most disciplined of his election campaigns to date and will be his chief of staff. The source said Trump's current team stuff is really buttoned down. In relation to Trump's current team, the source said stuff is really buttoned down. He may not need the family this time like he used to. CNN Cable News Network has covered the same story but from a different angle. A prominent Republican U.S. senator pledged on Sunday that Congress would not give blanket approval to Donald Trump's controversial cabinet picks ahead of the congressional confirmation process, as a leading Democrat challenged the qualifications of some of those who have been nominated. Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma predicted lawmakers in the upper chamber will have tough questions, in particular for the former Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who was chosen by the president-elect as Director of National Security for his second administration. When asked on CNN on Sunday morning if he will vote for all of Trump's cabinet nominations, Senator James Lankford did not answer directly, pointing to the Senate process of holding public hearings for nominees, beginning on 3rd of January, ahead of Trump's confirmation on 20th of January. He said of the president-elect's list of preferred nominees, "Everyone is going to get a fair shake." Tulsi Gabbard faces a potentially rough ride during her Senate confirmation hearing over a number of questionable incidents from her career. These include spreading Russian propaganda over the war in Ukraine, prompting critics to ask if she might be a Russian asset, as well as her making a clandestine visit to Syria to meet with the country's President Bashar al-Assad, a trip that drew criticisms from Republicans in particular. Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, the newly elected vice chair of the Senate Policy Committee, told CNN's State of the Union program, "We'll have lots of questions for Tulsi Gabbard." Lankford said she met with President Bashar Assad, will want to know what the purpose of that meeting was and what the direction for that was as a member of Congress. "We want to get a chance to talk about past comments that she's made and get them into full context." Senator Lankford added, "So sure, there's comments that are floating out there, but we want to be able to know the rest of the story." Senator Lankford's comments came at the end of a week that saw Donald Trump's first pick for Attorney General, Florida's former Congressman Matt Gaetz, fall amid sexual misconduct allegations, and that prompted pushback from a number of Republican senators and made it unlikely that he would win enough votes for confirmation. Other Trump choices under scrutiny include Fox TV host Pete Hegseth, the nominee for defense secretary, who was the subject of a sexual assault investigation in 2017, and also Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a conspiracy theorist and vaccine skeptic, who has been tapped for the position of health secretary. Senator James Lankford also suggested that Pam Bondi, Florida's former attorney general chosen by the president-elect this week in place of Matt Gaetz, should put aside her promise to seek legal retribution on Trump's political foes if she's confirmed. On the roll, Senator Lankford said, "It's America's lawyer. It's not the president's lawyer. It is very important that we get this role right and that they're actually focused on diminishing crime in America." Meanwhile, the Democratic Illinois senator and combat veteran Tammy Duckworth told CNN's State of the Union program that Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard were both unqualified or unsuitable for the roles that Donald Trump wants them to fill.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانا ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi. And Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of this program. Thank you for having me, Brother Mike.
Thank you for accepting our invitation, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program consists of several parts, all pertaining to the Holy Quran. At first, we are talking about a famous Quran reciter, and then we are going to listen to a recitation by that famous reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation, and then beside all these parts, we are going to have some other Quranic parts which are going to be presented to you throughout the program. So don't go away. On August 12, 2010, Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at a Quranic meeting said, If we want to benefit from the Holy Quran in the real sense of the word, we should become familiar with Quranic teachings and concepts. Reciting, memorizing, and establishing a close relationship with the Holy Quran help us on this path. Today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif. He is an Egyptian reciter who was born in 1943 in Ash-Sharqiyah Governorate. He entered Egyptian radio in 1979 and recited the Noble Quran in many official religious gatherings, including Friday prayers. During the Islamic month of Ramadan, he traveled to Arab and European countries as a representative of the Ministry of Endowment of Egypt to recite the verses of the Noble Quran. He passed away on August 15th, 2018, at the age of 75. May Allah bless his soul.
Brother Mahdi, there's one thing about the names of Egyptian reciters and Egyptian people in general.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they have their own name. For example, Mahmoud. Ismail is the name of their father.
Uh-huh.
Sharif is the name of their father's father, their grandfather. And that's how they know each other.
Interesting.
It's like their last name is the name of their father and their father's father, their grandfather. For example, Shahat Muhammad Anwar. Okay, it doesn't necessarily have to be three names. It could also be two names, such as Mustafa Ismail.
Well, I think beside people's grandfather's names, sometimes we can see the name of the cities where they were born. Am I right?
Yes, that's right. For example, we have Muhammad Siddiq al-Minshawi. Minshah. Mm-hmm. He was born in Minshah.
Or al-Dimenhuri.
Al-Bahtimi. Mm-hmm. He was born in the village Bahtim. Uh-huh. Dimenhuri, like we had in the previous program,
mm-hmm.
he was from
Dimenhur.
Or for example, Tantawi, mm-hmm. from Tanta, and so on and so forth.
Okay, thank you, Brother Muhammad. Now, dear audience, let's listen to the recitation of Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif reciting Surah As-Saffat, verses 139 to 148, preceded by its English translation. Let's enjoy it.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful. And verily, Jonah was one of the messengers. When he ran to the laden ship, he cast lots, and he was among the losers. Then a fish swallowed him, and he had done an act worthy of blame. Had he not been of them who glorify Allah, he would have indeed remained inside its belly till the day of resurrection. But we cast him forth on the naked shore while he was sick. And we caused a plant of gourd to grow over him. And we sent him to 100,000 or even more. And they believed, so we gave them enjoyment for a while.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa inna يونس لمن المرسلين إذ أبق إلى الفلك المشحون فساهم فكان من المدحضين فالتقمه الحوت وهو مليم فلولا أنه كان من المسبحين للبس في بطنه إلى يوم يبعثون فنبذناه بالعراء وهو سقيم وأنبتنا عليه شجرة من يقطين وأرسلناه إلى 100,000 أو يزيدون فآمنوا فمتعناهم إلى حين صدق الله العظيم.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, and what you just listened to was recitation of Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif reciting Surah As-Saffat verses 139 to 148. Now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, this reciter had a very good tajweed. The first tajweed point is Al-Murur Salim. The Ra has tafkhim without qalqala. So if you say Al-Murur Salim, is that correct?
No.
If you say Al-Murur Salim, is that correct?
Again, that is not right.
Because I pronounce it with takrir.
Yeah.
There should not be any takrir. Al-Murur Salim. Of course, you should not make such a pause on the Ra. I'm just emphasizing the lack of qalqala. Al-Murur Salim.
And the reason why we pronounce it with tafkhim is the lamma before this
yes,
sakin.
Yes, that's right. Whenever ra is sakin, most of the time you have to look at the previous letter.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a letter of istirla after the ra sakina, regardless of whether it's preceded by a kasra
or a fatha
or a fatha or dhamma, you have to pronounce it with
tafkhim. Like mirsad.
Yes, mirsad, qirtas, firqa, and so on and so forth. And the phrase fakana, the kaf was pronounced very well. We have to hear a distinct sound when pronouncing kaf, fakana.
The clicking sound.
It's like
a
clicking sound. I call it a clicking sound, but others might not call it a clicking sound. Ka, fakana. If you say fakana, that's incorrect. Because the place of articulation of kaf is not the Arabic kaf.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabic kaf is further back. It's just a little bit ahead of the place of articulation of qaf. Okay?
Yes. Kana.
Fakana.
And, it's close to English K, isn't it?
It's close, but not exactly the same. Mudahadin. The dad was pronounced with the lowest level of tafkhim. Mudahadin, din, dha. And the dad was pronounced correctly. Okay, up till now, he was reciting these verses using maqam bayati. Bayati is a very soothing maqam. It's a very beautiful maqam, which has some sorrow in it. And it's a calming maqam. And then I think from verse 141 or 42, he recites in maqam Saba. Saba is extremely sad maqam. And I think it's very appropriate whenever we consider the meaning of this verse, because the verse is about Prophet Yunus, Jonah. And it's the time when the fish swallowed him while he was blameworthy. Mm-hmm. Okay? So he was in the belly of the big fish, and that is why he uses Maqam Saba.
Mm-hmm.
And we read in the other verses of the Quran how he supplicates Allah in the belly of the fish and says, I have wronged myself, O Allah, forgive me. And then Allah answered his prayer.
Mm-hmm. So, La ilaha illa ant, subhanaka inni kuntu min al-dhalimin.
Yes. Okay, and then he changes to maqam bayati on and off. You know, he uses bayati saba, bayati saba.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Because, you know, bayati and saba are very similar. They have many similarities. We have qasr of matul munfasil. Falawla annahu.
Lawla annahu. We have a disjunct mad
here. We have a disjunct mad here, which means that if you want to do qasr, we have to lengthen it to only two vowel counts.
Matu tabi'i.
Yes. And the word yaqutin, tin, tin, not tin. Tin is incorrect. Tin. The ta is pronounced with the lowest level of tafkhim. That's the point.
Because it has a kasra.
It has a ya'ul mad or kasra.
Okay, thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. You're still listening to the program. Let's recite the Quran. Stay tuned. Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until next program, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye.
سبحان يا خالق الإنسان نورنا بالقرآن بمصحف الإيمان ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Displaced Lebanese civilians are returning to their homes amid celebrations following a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah. The United Nations welcomes the ceasefire deal between Lebanon and Israel, saying the considerable work lies ahead to implement this agreement. And Israel's latest air and artillery strikes killed dozens more civilians across the Gaza Strip, raising genocidal war's death toll to